Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my next guest, Jim Lattice, back in the studio with me. Great to have Jim back. He directs the University of Wisconsin's Space Place, the UW Space Place. He's a faculty associate in astronomy at UW-Madison. So he's going to be updating us on what's happening in the world of astronomy. We'll take a look at some upcoming events with him. And certainly look forward to hearing from you. What astronomy questions do you have? I hope you'll join in the conversation. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Having some problems with our email today, so we're not able to take email questions today, unfortunately, at least for now. Maybe it'll get fixed before the show's over. So give a call, 1-800-642-1234. Jim Lattice, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
You know, I've always enjoyed going to UW Space Place. It's really some cool, especially at night when we get the telescopes out. But talk about the Space Place itself and tell us what it's all about.
Sure. Space Place is, I guess we've been, it's been quite a few years now. It's going
yeah.
on. Boy, it's going on. Gee, it's going to be 30 years before too long, a couple more years. We started Space Place in 1990. Really as part of the overall outreach efforts of astronomy at Wisconsin, which go way back. You've probably heard me talk about this,
yeah.
but they've been when they first opened the Washburn Observatory, it had only been open about 2 years before they started opening it up to the public on a regular basis. And that's on my notes here that I want to mention Washburn Observatory, but I'll mention it now that the Washburn Observatory is open to the public on the first and third Wednesday nights of each month if the sky is clear. And that's been the schedule that we've held to since April of 1881. So we have a long tradition of astronomy outreach. So Space Place was a way to expand that into the more space-related activities
yeah.
that we have gotten into, really since the 1960s. And so Space Place is a part museum. We have a lot of important, artifacts that have telescopes, really, and instruments that have flown in space, and displays about why Wisconsin is such an active astronomy research center to this day, since 1881. Then we also have programs for schools and the general public. Our website is easy to find, spaceplace.org or spaceplace.wisca.edu. Either one of them will get you there. Such a good name that NASA stole it from us. You'll also find a NASA thing called Space Place. But look for the wisca.edu one, and you'll find the local Space Place in Madison.
And you have, you mentioned events and things. You do have some great presentations coming up. But before we even forget about it, let's talk about, you've got one scheduled tomorrow.
In fact, tomorrow. So we do this on the second Tuesday of every month. And that's the a presentation about, almost always about some aspect of research at UW. But it ranges quite broadly. And so the one tomorrow is about a really interesting documentary. It's the makers of a documentary of research, UW research in South Africa, part of which is astronomy. We're partners in one of the largest telescopes in the world called the Southern African Large Telescope, which is in the country of South Africa. But UW researchers are also doing fascinating research into not just the origins of the universe and the galaxy, but into the origins of life on Earth and the origins of human beings. And so this very interesting production called Origins was the subject of a UW communications, a university communications project. And we have the producers of that project who are going to give a talk about the making of that and give us some insights into the both the making of the thing and their experiences in that project.
That's really cool. We can talk about some more of those projects. I know there's another one coming up as well.
So 7 p.m. I should have said.
Oh, 7, yeah.
7 p.m. tomorrow night at Space Place. Open to the public, of course.
And right in Madison.
Yep.
All right. Let's take a call from Jim in Lake Geneva. and see what's on Jim's mind. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking the call. I just turned on the radio 2 minutes ago, and I heard this. I wanted to get this plug in. Right now, the largest refracting telescope in the entire world has been for sale for over a year in Williams Bay, Wisconsin. And Einstein studied there, as well as they shot some movies, big movies there. But it's for sale, the Yerkes Observatory. And I just wanted to mention that in case there's somebody out there that wants a piece of real history. The building is from the 1892-93 World's Fair Columbian Exposition in Chicago. It was moved up piece by piece.
Wow.
And lots of history there. Lots of acreage, too, I guess.
Well, Jim, thanks a lot for calling. Jim Lattice?
Yeah, that's certainly a famous Wisconsin observatory, and I like to claim it all the time, although it does belong to the University of Chicago, and they did build it there. My understanding of the status, I haven't actually seen it up for sale. My understanding of the status is that the University of Chicago is in negotiations with a private organization to operate it as a science center and basically as a historical site, as an astronomical museum. So I don't know what the status of that is. Those are private negotiations, but we're all hopeful that will come out well,
for sure.
Just until last fall. You could go to Yerkes Observatory there, actually in Williams Bay on the shore of Lake Geneva. And there were tours there and astronomical activities and things like that. I've given a number of talks there and taken a number of groups there. And we, UW-Madison, have a long history of collaboration with them going back to the 1920s. Our astronomers used to collaborate quite a bit with them in the early days. Some of the innovative instruments that we were building and developing here in the 1920s, 1930s, were in demand at other observatories right away because they were so interesting and successful. And Yerkes was one of the first early adopters of Wisconsin photometers. So we do have a long history there, and we're very interested in how that will go. If it's up for sale, that's news to me.
All right, there we go. Jim, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Well, I'm thinking about what's going on in the night sky. I know that we have a blue moon on Saturday, and explain what that is.
Well, yeah, so this is actually... It turns out blue moon is something that people reinvent from time to time, what it means. And the conventional definition that we run into these days, the most common one that people use, is when you have an extra full moon, that is basically more than one, in a calendar month. And so it takes 29 and a half days to go from a full moon to a full moon. So you have to have... at least a 30-day month. So a 31 or a 30-day month, if you have a full moon right at the beginning of that month, then 29 and a half days later, you'll get another one. So that second moon is often called a blue moon. But that's actually not not the original definition of a blue moon. If you look at the year as a whole, it's very inconvenient. There's not an even number of full moons in a solar year. You either have 12 or you have 13. So you average it out somewhere along in the long run. But in the years when you have 13, in the years when you have 12, well, you've got three per quarter. But in the years when you have 13, one of those quarters has got to have four. And so the old definition was, and I don't have any idea why this is, the old definition was that not the fourth one in the quarter, but the third one in the quarter was called the blue moon.
Ah.
And that's a little more abstruse than the other one, right? You can't just look at the calendar and figure this one out. So the one that we're coming up on the 18th of May, that's a blue moon by the old definition. So it's not, you'll see, it's on the 18th of May there. It's not right at the beginning of May or right at the end of the May.
Yeah.
So it's not one of the more modern blue moon definitions. So this is a real traditional blue moon. It's still just going to look like a full moon.
It's but not going to be blue.
Not going to be blue, no. But you know, it's great to look at the moon. Is a great sight anytime. So when you see that full moon rising there on the 18th, then that's our blue moon in this quarter of the year.
Well, I remember my mother using that term from time to time. Once, you know.
Sure.
You do that? Oh, once in a blue moon.
Yeah, so that's, and now I should have looked up how often we get those. I didn't think to do that. It's not really all that rare because, again, we have either 12 or 13. So you got to squeeze in a blue moon. I mean, not a blue moon. No, you got to squeeze in an extra full moon into a calendar year pretty regularly, and it's got to fall somewhere. So that's going to be a blue moon.
So it's not as rare as kind of the it sounds when somebody uses that term in conversation.
Yeah, it's not. Well, I guess it depends on how rare they want things to be. But yeah, I mean, the moon is very rarely blue, very rarely blue in color. Atmospheric conditions can make it look
bluish. Yeah,
what
kind of atmospheric conditions?
Oh, high altitude dust and things like that could affect it. Perhaps tends more often atmospheric makes the moon reddish, but there are conditions under which it can be bluish.
Talking today with Jim Lattice, director of the UW Space Place. It's always fun to have Jim come by. We're talking about, of course, spring stargazing with him, and he's got a lot more to talk about. Well, as we visit, I know there's some planetary motion that he wants to talk about and some other things as well. And certainly look forward to your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll be back with Jim Lattice right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Doing a little stargazing right now here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, Jim Lattice in the studio with me, director of the UW Space Place, a faculty associate in the Department of Astronomy at UW-Madison. Are you interested in learning more about astronomy, maybe about the night sky? I hope you'll join in. Give a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. And I'm almost betting that on Wednesday, there'll even though most of the questions are going to be about Wisconsin, there may be about some meteors or whatever fell into Wisconsin. We're going to school, going back to school on Wednesday for a live broadcast from Mineral Point Elementary School. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'll be joined by a live audience of curious fourth graders who have a lot of questions about the history of our great state. And so that's going to be, you're going to want to tune into that. You can join in too and call with your own questions, but there are a lot of questions that these fourth graders from Mineral Point have for, well, not so much for me, but for my two guests who know a lot more than I know about the state of Wisconsin. By the way, meteors, you know, what are the most famous? Do we have any famous ones from Wisconsin?
Oh, well, yeah, you mean meteorite falls.
Yeah.
Sure. We've had a few just the last, last decade or so. There have been some nice ones. There was one out when was that? Boy, about 5-6 years ago that dropped some sizable chunks of meteorite out into sort of southwestern Dane County and a little bit beyond there. There are geological signs of significant impacts, but of course nothing of those magnitude have been seen in historical times. But every so often, it's actually not at all unusual. If you spend much time looking at the sky, you will see some really bright meteors that are typically called fireballs. And those things are often, these days, are often caught on camera. And so there's enough security cameras and dash cams, and people record them with their cell phones or whatever, that actually scientists are learning a lot more about where those things come from, what sort of orbit they're in when they intersect with the Earth. So they're scientifically more interesting for that reason than they are if we get a particle intact on the ground. That's when we call it a meteorite. Then those are still of interest too, but they have a whole new dimension now because of the ubiquity of video recording. You just need two or three good video images of them, and you can figure out just how high they are and where they're going.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Zachary in Menominee, we'll give you a chance now. Hi.
Hi. So my question is, just about everybody has access to a cell phone, in my case Android. What's the best app to see like where potential objects are, where a meteor shower is going to be?
Well, there are so many of them out there that I hesitate to pronounce one of them best. There's sort of a category of free ones, and in that case, you should just download a couple of the free ones. I could toss out a couple of names, but Stellarium is one. At least I think. Sorry,
Stargazer. I like that one.
Yeah, you like Stargazer?
I've got that one. Yeah.
Star. Something called Star Walk. One called Go Skywatch. So there's a bunch of free ones out there that you can just try out, and then there are some higher end ones. I particularly like one called Sky Safari. I'm pretty sure they make that for both. I use it on an iPhone, but I'm pretty sure they make it on both platforms.
What's nice about it?
Well, a couple of things. It's costs a few bucks, but it has really good tools for predicting things like, say, planetary conjunctions or alignments that you might be interested in. It's got a really good set of reference tables in there, and it's got really good information files on, say, I use it a lot, say, if I'm showing people a binary star in a telescope, and somebody will always say, well, how long does it take for those two to orbit around each other? And I don't actually remember that, but I can find it out right away with Sky Safari. So it's just pretty well equipped, and it's a really good interface. That is to say, when you want it in order to control it, which is important on a small screen like a phone. So those would be that's where I would say start. I would definitely start with the free ones and experiment with those a little bit. And a lot of them have a trial version. I don't think Sky Safari does, but some of them will have a trial version. Then you can upgrade by paying a few bucks.
Yeah, and Star Tracker, if I'm out for my jog in the morning, it's often before light. And if I'm going along and I'm looking up and I see, what the heck?
Yeah, sure. What is that bright thing?
I just point the phone at it.
Yeah, right. Most of them, I guess, will do that these days. We'll go into that mode where you can sort of orient the phone and
right.
Try to overlay the screen on the sky. Yeah, that takes a little bit of practice to get the hang of that.
Yeah.
That's pretty useful.
Zachary, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Bob in Iola, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Bob.
Hey. Good show, as usual. If I'm redundant on this, I missed the first half of your show. I saw a meteor during the day on Saturday. It was headed north to south. I was wondering if it was possibly a piece of that Indian space junk. They blew up one of their own satellites. And the bigger question was, what percentage of, if anybody knows, of meteorites that we're seeing now are space junk versus normal stuff? And this was, it went from silver to green. It was pronounced, and it was like 8 o'clock at night.
Hmm. Wow. That sounds like a great one. Pretty hard to say. I don't know. In that case, you might be able to see it unless you were the only one, which is unlikely. You can try the International Meteor Society website, and there's a directory there of reported fireballs.
Oh.
And so you can actually report it there if you have enough details. I don't have that website right.
And what,
right,
what's the name of it again?
International Meteor Society, I think, is right. I think
International Meteor Society.
Society, I think, is their IMS, yeah. Or maybe it's IMO. We should check here in a minute. But but they maintain a directory and accept reports of that sort of thing. So if you saw one that was bright enough, you know, at that time of day in a fairly bright sky, you said 8 p.m., that's, you know, about sunset these days, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then and if you saw it change colors, that's pretty cool. They natural ones do that as well. Doesn't have to be a piece of, you know, of a satellite in order to do that. But that's pretty interesting. It's pretty hard to tell just from its path, from north to south. That will inevitably be, if it is a piece of space junk, that will inevitably reflect the orbit, the orientation of the orbit with respect to your location at that time. But without knowing a particular satellite, it's impossible to tell.
But Bob, if I were you, I'd go to that international.
I'll see if I can find it.
Yeah, we'll look it up. IMO or IMS, but we'll get a look. I'm sure Jim Lattice is going to have that up in a couple of seconds. Jim, by the way, is director of the UW-Madison Space Place. And if you have a question for him, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234.
So I was wrong about society. It's organization, International Meteor Organization, and the website is pretty easy. It's just www.imo.net.
IMO.net.
Yeah, okay. IMO.net. And that's where, as I said, they'll keep you can find there a log of reported bright meteors and things.
All right.
Lots
there we
of
go.
Other information.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it. Vern in Wilson, we'll go to you next. Hi, Vern.
Okay. Hi. Yeah. Here's the thing. We always have an unknown variable on these orbits of these asteroids and other objects. What happens if the sun emits an immense CME, you know, coronal mass ejection? And it causes the asteroid to deviate its path. So we really can't predict for certain what these things are going to do because we can't predict the CMEs.
Yeah.
I guess that's true of most of life. I mean, something can always come along and then your best predictions go astray. It would take a heck of a CME to deflect an asteroid. I mean, those things are relatively dense sorts of things. And I've never heard of that. Happening that a CME could actually deflect an asteroid. NASA does track them though. So if one mm-hmm. of them did shift, they would adjust its orbit. And in fact, that's pretty common. You do a sudden event like that. Like I said, I never heard of that, but a sudden event like that. Could happen. They could also, there could be a collision between two asteroids or something like that, and would shift the orbits too.
Sure.
I've never heard of that either. But we do see them shifted all the time because of the steady gravitational influence of especially Jupiter. It changes their orbits from, if there were only the sun and the asteroid, you'd have a perfect Keplerian orbit. It would be in a perfect ellipse, but it gets tugged on by Jupiter, everything else too, but Jupiter's mm-hmm. the big effect that shifts that orbit constantly. And so the orbit trackers at NASA have to take that into account. So they're actually pretty much constantly updating the asteroids that they track. But yeah, of course, some sudden unforeseen force can act on them and then they change.
And thanks for that call. Appreciate it. Don had called and couldn't hang on, but wondered why Leo is considered a summer constellation, but it comes up in the spring.
Huh. Well, I actually always thought of it as a spring constellation. I think it depends on what time you tend to do your stargazing. If you observe after midnight, then you're going to see Leo at quite a bit earlier in the year than if you observe just around sunset, just after sunset. So I don't know. To me, it's on my list here of spring constellations.
Well, what about what we can see in the night sky right now, let's say at a reasonable hour?
Yeah, well, so if you say about 10 p.m. Or something, then Leo is quite prominent right now. Actually, the way I like to describe it to people about this time of year, and again, now I'm talking about the sort of middle evening sky, not if you go out after midnight or whatever. And almost right overhead is where you find the Big Dipper this time of year. Not directly overhead, but almost directly overhead, a little bit off to the north. And there's kind of a circuit of stars that you could have, if you were looking at a star chart and you followed the handle of the Big Dipper. So you look up, you see the Big Dipper, you kind of follow the curve of the Big Dipper away from the, follow the curve of the handle away from the Big Dipper, and it'll point you over towards a nice bright star called Arcturus, which is the brightest star in the sky. And you can kind of continue this down to another fairly bright star called Spica. So stargazers from time immemorial have talked about arcing along the handle of the Big Dipper, arc to Arcturus and speed to Spica. That gives you sort of one side of a kind of a region of the sky overhead. And if you go back to the Big Dipper and use a couple of the stars in the bowl, ones that are right next to the handle, follow them and they'll point you down to yet another bright star, which is Regulus in Leo. And those lines kind of bound a region of the sky, which is especially dark and clear. There aren't too many bright stars up there within that region. And when you're looking out in that direction of the sky, you're looking out of the galaxy. You're looking, if you were now to look at your star chart again to look where the Milky Way is, what you'd see is that the Milky Way is running roughly around the horizon at this point. So if you were standing in the plane of the Milky Way, and we are at about that time and about this time of year, you look overhead, you're looking out of the galaxy. And that's what this used to puzzle astronomers. This was a historical puzzle. Why are there so many galaxies when we look out in that sort of a window out of the galaxy? We don't see as many of these external galaxies. They didn't even know they were external galaxies when we look in other directions in the sky, especially closer to the plane of the Milky Way. So we're looking out that window, and that's where some of the most famous and most distant galaxy clusters and things that if you look at flipping through an astronomy book and you see the Coma cluster or the Hercules cluster, that's where you're looking. You're looking right out of the plane of the Milky Way. So that's what we have overhead. Now, that's not a thing for small telescopes, those kind of distant galaxies and things like that. But that's the overall, you're getting the benefit of that overall geometry of the galaxy there, and those constellations will direct you direct your view that way.
Very cool. Andreas and Gaze Mills, we'll give you a chance now. Hi there.
Hello. Happy spring.
To you as well.
I just wanted to share my experience when the Mifflin meteorite came through. I was in a meeting in Boscobel on the main street, right next to the Boscobel Hotel, and it was dark out, but suddenly it became as bright as day, blue sky, and felt a shock wave. And I remember looking around at the other people. We all felt this, and a picture fell off the wall. So maybe we were 30 miles from Montford area, but still felt that shock wave. And it was really cool to go to the geology museum recently and see some chunks of that meteorite.
Oh, that one. Yeah, right. I was going to ask you which one you were talking about. So when do you remember what year that was?
Maybe around 2009, 2010.
Yeah, okay. That sounds about right. A little bit longer than I thought. Yeah, that's right. I'd forgotten about that. They do have some chunks, some collected pieces from that event at the Geology Museum on the UW campus.
Yeah,
right.
Very cool. Well, that's an experience you're not going to forget, Andreas.
I hadn't heard that it knocked a picture off a wall. That's pretty good.
that's pretty cool. Thank you very much for telling us about your experience. Margaret in Green Bay has a question, though, so let's go there. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. My question is not about tonight's sky, but it's more general. I know we know about the Big Bang theory and how far out matter from the Big Bang extends, but could there be now that we find out more about other universes, could there be universes out there that were there before the Big Bang?
Well, it's hard to pin that kind of thing down. So I think it's fair to say what we know about the Big Bang is what we infer from looking at the universe around us. We look at what we see around us, and there's various forms of evidence that we take into account, including something called the cosmic background radiation, but also the chemical makeup of our universe, the ratio of hydrogen to helium and things like that. And those tell us certain things about the event that gave rise to the universe that we live in right now. It doesn't tell us whether some other universe might have arisen in the same event. And there, in fact, are people who kick around theoretical ideas of exactly that sort, that there might have been more than one universe created in that that event that sort of by definition we don't have any access to. We can't draw on those for the evidence that we use to try to investigate the Big Bang. So it's pretty hard for me to say we could rule out one thing or another. All I can really say is that that the evidence that we see around us in our universe points back to that origin that we identify as the Big Bang. But the sources of that, and again, there are theoretical ideas about all kinds of things, but the nature of that event and the sources for that are pretty much up for grabs, still pretty much up for a lot of theoretical discussion, but not much empirical investigation.
There we go. Thank you so much. Jan wondered when the Perseid meteor shower would be visible this year.
Yeah, good question. So since we've got meteors have come up here several times now, most of the ones that we've been talking about so far are not associated with showers. Typically, there are roughly two kinds of meteors. Well, I guess there are really three if we include space junk that we put up there and then falls back down. So those are artificial in a sense. We also asteroids came up earlier. We get bits and pieces from the asteroid belt from time to time that are just sort of produce a steady influx of meteors, usually that you can see in the sky, a few per hour, and a few of those are massive enough then to do like we had the report from Gaze Mills there. Mm-hmm. But the other kind of meteor that we see in the sky is the ones that come along in bunches at a certain time of year, usually a pretty strictly defined time of year, because they're associated with a comet. They're effectively debris from a comet, and so they where that comet intersects the Earth's origin, we get a meteor shower, and we get that this year on the 13th of August is the peak of the meteors. Unfortunately, the moon's going to be nearly full by that time.
Unfortunately. Well, Jim, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. The events he talked about, go to UW Space Place. If you type that in, you're going to find out about the event tomorrow and the one coming up on June 7th and all the other events that they have. So please do that. And in the meantime, thanks for listening, Pat. Tricia Skalka back with us to talk about her Dave Kubiak County Mystery book. That's tomorrow. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store.